The holidays are here, and that means family, friends, and heartwarming homemade flavors. Celebrate the season at Charlu's Tap House in Anderson, where tradition, taste, and togetherness come to life. Warm up with our made-from-scratch soups and signature family sauces, crafted from cherished recipes passed down through generations. Watch the magic happen when we hand-toss every pizza to order, then bake it to perfection, crispy, cheesy, and made with love. Let the little ones explore our brand-new adventure room. With bounce houses, arcade games, and even a make-your-own pizza table where the kids can make their own pizza. While they play, you can relax with happy hour daily from 3 to 6, or pour your favorite brew from our self-serve beer wall featuring dozens of local and craft options. And don't forget the perfect stocking stuffer. Buy a $50 Charlu's gift card and get an extra $10 free. The gift of homemade flavor, family fun, and unforgettable memories. Visit charlus.com for details, or stop by on Highway 273 in Anderson. Charlu's Tap House, where good times, great flavor, and family traditions come together for the holidays.
I'm Tracy Edwards, CEO of the Redding Rancheria. Giving back to our local community is a tradition that is firmly rooted in our history.
Hi, I'm Ted Bambino, president of the Redding Rodeo. We are thrilled to be partners with the Redding Rancheria. They are an integral part to the success of the Redding Rodeo.
Hi, I'm Julie. This is Debbie. We're here at the Shasta Family YMCA.
Hi, and I'm Kristen, the CEO. And on behalf of our team, I'd like to thank the Redding Rancheria for the many years of support for our programs and our projects like the playground.
Redding Rancheria, proud to play our part.
Now is a great time to prepare for the upcoming wildfire season. REU and city staff are busy clearing vegetation to mitigate wildfire risk to our power lines, facilities, and the community. You can also prepare by trimming back shrubs and tree branches that are closer than 5 feet from your home. Clear debris from your roof and gutter and clear dead vegetation on your property. For information about tree trimming and proximity to power lines, call 530-224-4356. Please remember, we all need to work together to prevent wildfires in our community.
Hi, this is Judy Maxwell.
The historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
Everyone loves the nativity scene. Where did all that begin? Well, actually, it began in the 13th century, the 1200s, with St. Francis of Assisi. He wanted to find a new way, really, to celebrate the nativity.
This is your host, Scott Bertrand. Welcome to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, part of the Hillsdale College Podcast Network. That was Dr. Ken Calvert, professor of ancient history here at Hillsdale College. Today we talk about the history of Christmas. Also later on in today's program, Dr. Chloe Carmichael is with us. Her new book is Can I Say That? Why Free Speech Matters and How to Use It Fearlessly. First, we're joined by Dr. Ken Calvert. He is professor of ancient history here at Hillsdale College. Dr. Calvert, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Scott. Good to be here.
Digging into the history of Christmas today. Tis the season.
It is.
And there's a long history. And thankfully, we have you, the expert, to join us.
Right.
Let's start at the beginning.
Okay.
So how and maybe why and when did Christmas first come to be celebrated in the Christian tradition?
Right. So we look at December 25th, you know, as the date, and there has been all kinds of confusion about why that date is the date that we celebrate Christmas. Since about the 18th century, the 1700s AD, there has been this idea that somehow Constantine established the December 25th as the date. And what befuddles me as an ancient historian is there is absolutely no evidence that Constantine made that happen. They also say that he established Sunday as the day for, you know, celebration. That there are even people who say that he wrote the New Testament or had, you know, so all kinds of strange things about Constantine that come out. Constantine, you know, you can debate who he was. I've got my own opinions about that guy, but in the end, he actually, during his reign, we find confirmation that Christmas had been celebrated on December 25th for quite a long time.
Mm-hmm.
It shows up on a calendar in the city of Rome, not in Constantinople where Constantine is at, but in the city of Rome, it shows up that December 25th is the date. Now, where did they get that? And how long had Christians been doing that? And when you look at the evidence, it actually goes back quite early. And so I want to try and unpack the biblical roots of this so that, you know, we kind of can wrap our head around this. And it begins with Zechariah, okay, the father of John the Baptist, the husband of Elizabeth, right? And we are told that he is in the temple, you know, acting as a priest, and he is told that he's going to have a son. And he questions that, right? And then he's struck dumb for, you know, the next 9 months and makes Elizabeth very happy. Actually, I'm reading into scripture, so that might not have happened. Anyway, the idea here is that what has happened and when this happens, okay? And there is a suggestion among theologians and from fairly early on that what Zechariah is doing in the temple is during a high feast.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And so when we look at the calendar, Jesus is born before the death of Herod the Great, and Herod dies in 4 BC. And so Jesus had to have been born 2 years earlier, 6 BC, or maybe 7 BC.
Dr. Calvert, how do we know some of this? How are we so certain or think we are so certain about some of this timeline?
What's wonderful about Judaism is their record keeping.
Uh-huh.
And we have records of high feasts, like the Feast of the Atonement, the Feast of Tabernacles in 6 BC is all around between the 24th and the 27th of September. So maybe the 25th of September, mm-hmm. right around that time. Okay. 6 months later, the Gospels tell us that Mary agrees to carry this child, right? And she is told in the Gospel of Luke, go visit your relative Elizabeth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we don't know how they're relatives at all. Only Elizabeth is older and had been barren, and this is a miraculous child, John the Baptist, right? And so she goes to visit Elizabeth, and we are told that she stays 3 months, all right? She stays 3 months until Elizabeth gives birth to her baby. So the 9 months for Elizabeth would be from September, you know, up until June.
Yeah.
Right? Okay. Now, when then would we calculate the conception of Jesus to be? Well, 6 months after September, which is March,
mm-hmm.
March 25th. And then what's 9 months after March 25th? December 25th. And so from Scripture, and, you know, the early church is looking at this, and they're seriously considering all of these, you know, dates. And now there is a difference in calendars between the Eastern calendar and the Western calendar. For the Eastern calendar, it lands around January 6th. For the Western calendar, around December 25th. And if you wonder in the modern day why you have these differences, it's because of the way in which through this history over the last 2,000 years, East and West marked time on their calendars. But it's, if you go back to that first century, it's the same day. Okay. Now, what's interesting about the early church is that they were not so much interested in the date when Jesus is born in Bethlehem. What they are interested in is the date of conception, that March 25th. And so what they do is you have a number of people, Julius Africanus, Tertullian, a man named Hippolytus. This is all in 2nd and 3rd century Christianity, in which you have a number of theologians and apologists at work defending Christianity. And Hippolytus, in his commentary on the book of Daniel, which is this book that talks about, you know, the calendrical data between the Daniel and the time of the coming of Jesus, you know, this is 400 years. And he figures this out, that what happened was, that in related to Zechariah, that Jesus is conceived on March 25th. And therefore is born on December 25th. And these different Christians are all agreeing on this.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And so this is very important, that when we get back to this issue of Constantine creating Christianity on December 25th, right, what's really going on here is what Constantine is doing, or at least what happens during Constantine's era. I don't think he actually did anything relating to Christmas,
mm-hmm.
right? But what he was doing, perhaps, in the calendrical construction that we find during his time is affirming that the Christians had already been seeing December 25th as the birth date of Jesus, and more importantly, March 25th as the day of his conception, of Christ's conception.
Hmm.
Now, you pour into this an emperor named Aurelian, who is in the midst of a very tumultuous era in 3rd century Rome, the 270s, going back to the 240s, an era that some historians call the era of the barracks emperors, where general after general after general is trying to take over the Roman Empire. And what Aurelian does, somewhere between 270 and 275, is introduce a new god, a new cult to the Roman religious system. It's the worship of Sol Invictus, of the invincible sun, solar worship, right? And this is something that Constantine, years later, his father also worshiped the same god. So this is where there's confusion with solar worship and Sol Invictus. Now, what Aurelian does is choose December 25th as the festival for the worship of Sol Invictus.
Dr. Ken Calvert with us talking about the history of Christmas. Dr. Calvert, why that date? Why the 25th of December, perhaps?
The 25th, right, being the winter solstice.
Uh-huh.
It's the moment at which there's more sunshine and less darkness, right? And it could be that he's just doing this because this is a popular military god. So it might be that. And in fact, there had been some arguments over whether or not this divinity would be introduced. But Aurelian does this. There's another possibility here, that what he's trying to do is cover up Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Because they'd been celebrating on the March 25th and December 25th. And remember that in Malachi, the Messiah is called the Sun, S-U-N, of righteousness. In Numbers, there's a messianic prophecy about the star, okay, the Messiah being the star. So this idea of solar imagery and light, the Gospel of John, okay, the light has come into the world, right? The darkness, knew him not. This idea of light and sunshine. Okay, this is part of Christian imagery and something that is often forgotten when we talk about Christian art, that it's, in Scripture, and that Jesus really is, the light of the world.
Yeah.
And so is Aurelian trying to cover up the Christian celebration with a pagan celebration? Or a third option, which is least likely, is he trying to bring the Christians into the Roman world? Is he trying to make it easier for them to practice their Christianity and celebrate on the 25th, Sol Invictus or Jesus? And so this is something that is often just really ignored and not attempting to understand it. I think it's really, really crucial, because when December 25th is confirmed later on in the calendars, and particularly during the time of Constantine when we have this calendar in Rome, there are other pagan celebrations listed alongside December 25th as the Christian celebration. Sol Invictus, Saturnalia, these things are going on all about the same time. And the one thing that makes sense to me at the time of Constantine is Christians have become legal, and so their celebrations are as verifiable and justifiable as the pagan. So I think that's really important for us to understand why December 25th has come down to us as this important date. Yeah.
Talking to Dr. Ken Calvert, professor of ancient history, about the history of Christmas. How would early Christians then celebrate Christmas? And when would it begin to look like something we'd recognize today?
Right. I think it's really hard for us to understand this. There are moments in the history of the early church, particularly in the 3rd and the 4th century, where we have statements regarding the celebration of Christ's birth in relation or in contrast to the pagans. Jerome of Jerusalem talks about this. Other writers talk about this, Clement of Alexandria. And what they portray here is the idea that celebrations among the pagans during this time, during December with the Saturnalia or other celebrations, are celebrations typical to celebration of too much food, too much drink, sexual immorality, being involved in all of the corruption of wealth and power. And that is so typical of the Romans and their worship of their gods, because mm-hmm. they viewed the gods as having made them these great and powerful, wealthy and luxurious people, mm-hmm. right? And Christianity is just the opposite. It's about humility. It's about bowing before the true God of the universe and the true King of the universe. And so what do the Christians seem to do during this era? There is the statement, they fill themselves with food. They fill themselves with wine and all of these gifts. What are we going to do? We're going to give the poor food. We're going to give the wine to the poor, make their day happy. We're going to give gifts to the poor. And this is an important part of really the tradition of Christian practice during Christmas. And you see this even in the 12 days of Christmas and in the octave of Christmas, that during this time, Christians are showing mercy and grace to their neighbors, to the poor, to those who are in need, which is exactly what Christ, you know, expects of us. You know, Matthew 25, this idea of reaching out to the prisoner and to the mm-hmm. poor and to the, you know, those who are in need, the sick. And so this is what Christmas seems to be for the Christians.
Dr. Calvert, should we say something here about the earliest known Christmas hymn?
So I like to point out, when we're talking about Christmas and our time of worship and gathering, is that the first known Christmas hymn from the 4th century AD, actually about the same time as St. Nicholas, was written by a man named Prudentius, of the Father's love begotten, which I've heard in almost every church I've gone to, you know, of the Father's love begotten, ere the world began to be. Just a beautiful hymn. It's one of our earliest Christmas hymns. This relates to, you know, one of the most famous Christians and Christmas, and that is St. Nicholas, a 4th century bishop who, by the way, attended the Council of Nicaea. He was there. And Nicholas was known in his life because he had been wealthy. And as a Christian bishop, he began to give his wealth away. And particularly the famous story is, you know, he gave little bags of money to a poor man who had daughters and had no dowry, you know, to go with them. And so, you know, the Bishop Nicholas was tossing these bags of coins into the window of this poor man. And then, you know, a further story develops that these bags land in shoes, you know, the idea uh-huh. of the socks, you know, and the stockings, you know, that kind of thing. And so, you know, this idea of it being a day of mercy, because that's what Christmas is all about, God showing his mercy to us, is very much a part of the ancient tradition.
Mm. What elements of our modern Christmas celebration are perhaps distinctly American inventions even?
Right, right. So I think St. Nicholas riding on a sleigh being pulled by reindeer, you know,
That's us.
That's right. That's right. Really a 1950s invention,
yeah.
Now become kind of standard, and the whole story of Rudolph and all that kind of thing. And, you know, again, I don't want to be a curmudgeon and to, you know, to pop everybody's bubble. But, you know, the idea that Santa Claus is going house to house to house and giving gifts, that's basically St. Nicholas, mm-hmm. you know. And so, you know, that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. You know, adding a sleigh with reindeer, that comes out of Nordic tradition. And, you know, you follow the Dutch and Norwegian and the Nordic traditions. You have some of these stories connecting there. Now, in the Netherlands, people are a little embarrassed that he was served by a number of black slaves who helped him with his work. We've done away with that uh-huh. now, and I think the Dutch have done away with that as well. But, you know, all kinds of things that attended this story. And, you know, peculiarly American, especially after World War II, it becomes much more of a commercial kind of enterprise, mm-hmm. much more of a materialistic kind of idea. And we lose a little bit of sight of it, but there is in all of this, you know, the giving of gifts, which is what Christ is to us, St. Nicholas, you know, delivering these gifts, which is a beautiful idea, that's still there. There's still that kernel, you know, in the midst of it. And a time of joy and of light, you know, the lights on the tree, you know, Christ is the light coming into the world. All of that is still pointing back to the original meaning.
If we look at how Christmas has evolved in some ways that you've laid out, what does that tell us about the way that, that faith and culture interact and how the sacred and secular can influence each other?
Right. And this, too, has been a part of the Christian story all along. For instance, trying to explain the nativity, trying to explain the incarnation to a pagan world where a god would never become a human being in the way that they're describing. The Christians are attempting to do this, and you head off into all kinds of strange directions and heresies and things like that. Finally, the church comes around to the Council of Nicaea and Council of Chalcedon and is able to give Christians the language to be able to express what's going on in Scripture, right, and what's there. And this is true, you know, all through history, all through the history of the church, that in trying to explain very difficult things, right, we can go off the rails fairly easily. And in the modern world, too, you know, trying to explain this within a secular society that is dominated by, you know, scientific empiricism, how do you get after all of this and try to help people understand that we believe it's not a myth that this actually happened, that God actually became flesh? And so, you know, to use the language to kind of try and explain to folks, you know, what all of this means, that there is more to existence than what we can just touch and feel, that there is a God, you know, getting to that point of believing, you know, that there is a God, there is a mind, a logos that has created. And of course, logos, you know, central in the Gospel of John, that itself is a Christmas story. That itself is part of the nativity. Mm-hmm. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word, you know, when you want to know who God, well, Jesus' true father is, you know, there, you know, in the Gospel of John, it's stated very clearly, yeah. Right? And so getting people around to the idea that there is a logos, there is a mind, that there is a person who not only created all of this that we can study and pursue, and by God's grace, we have the reason to be able, the logic to be able to do this. What a wonderful miracle is man to be able to look at these things. And then to take them from that point of believing in a God to, here's a God who really loves us, who is intimately involved with us. And then from that point, the Christmas story that he became flesh, right, and lived among us. This is such a great opportunity, and sometimes we miss it, and we want to make it friendly and fun and full of great songs and all of that. And none of that is in and of themselves wrong,
yeah,
right? But to follow that up or attend that with, you know, a good understanding of what this really means, I think is extremely important. It's of the greatest importance, right?
We will continue in a moment with Dr. Ken Calvert talking about the history of Christmas. But first, I'll ask you a question. Do you like the conversation you're listening to right now? We want to know. Visit podcast.hillsdale.edu. Click on the pop-up and take our very first listener survey for the Hillsdale College Podcast Network that includes your thoughts on this show, the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Tell us what you like, what you dislike, and what you want to hear from us in the future. It will help out immensely. Please visit podcast.hillsdale.edu, click the pop-up, take our survey. Thank you for your feedback, and thank you for listening. We continue with Dr. Ken Calvert, professor of ancient history here at Hillsdale College, as we dig deep into the history of Christmas. Dr. Calvert, this is a little bit off your field of expertise, but you mentioned post-World War II.
Right.
And I look back at that, and I wonder, I'm curious, because there is such an explosion of music and movies,
yes,
and traditions and all these things that start right in a two-decade maybe period,
yeah,
that linger to this day, that continue to this day. Why do you think that happened? Do we lay that all at the feet of commerce? Is there more happening here?
There's more happening, absolutely. And yes, you know, we can talk about it in a more cynical way. It's commercial, it's materialism, and all of that stuff. But I grew up with a veteran of World War II who saw combat, killed people, and people tried to kill him. And what do I see in my father and what do I see in this generation? There is a kind of relief and joy that some of us survived this. Let's make the most of it. We defeated Hitler. We put boundaries on Stalin, on this atheistic, anti-Christian, violently anti-Christian set of movements in Nazi socialism and in Stalinist communism, that we did that. And what we should do is be thankful for that and therefore turn to, you know, the one that we worship that, you know, helped us to be victorious, or whose providential design was that we be victorious. And so I think Christmas in my mind emerges in those decades as a moment in which you can just have a great celebration of life, of, you know, defeating evil, of moving on with new things in human history, all of which gets us back to the Christmas story. The life that comes from that, the defeat of evil that comes through Christ, and all of the joy and possibility of the future. I see that not only in the United States, but in England. You know, I've spent a lot of time in England, and friends who just love Christmas, and parents and grandparents who loved Christmas. You see this in Europe and in so many places where, you know, people who survived all of this were then able to just unlock all of this joy.
We've talked a lot about different traditions and symbols. I don't think we've mentioned the Christmas tree itself. Where does that come into the picture?
According
to symbolize?
Yeah, according to my reading, and again, this hasn't been entirely comprehensive, but that the first Christmas trees were the with Queen Victoria in Buckingham Palace. Why did she choose this? Well, you know, she's, you know, that whole family is related to Germanic tradition and to the Germans. And, in fact, you know, many of the kings that came before her, monarchs came before her, didn't even speak English. You know, all they knew was German. But, I think that, you know, from what I've read, is that this is a tradition that she brought perhaps from Germanic background, but wanted to install and instill in English culture a symbol that was truly a symbol of Christmas. And what is the tree? The tree, I don't know, a symbol of life, of greenery. And on it, you know, the lights, the candles that were originally on that tree. And the idea of a creche, of a nativity scene, fairly early related to the Christmas tree. The idea that fruit grows on a tree. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that is a symbol of life and health. You know, also part of this, that the round, Christmas ornaments that we buy and put on our tree, you know, symbols of fruit growing on a tree and of life. So, you know, all of that is a little bit puzzling, honestly, to everyone. But the Christmas tree practice and image is decidedly takes hold in England and America during the Victorian age, and then becomes standard, you know, throughout. Yeah.
And are you a live Christmas tree person or a fake Christmas tree person?
Well, I tell you what, while the kids were young, it was always live. But after a time, we get tired of vacuuming up the needles, and here as we grow older and our children are all grown up and have their own families and their own Christmas traditions, or trees, we have now moved to the fake, which actually is pretty amazing.
Yes.
how soft they are and how realistic they look.
A lot of advances in fake tree technology over the decade.
Right, exactly. Another spinoff of Christmas, you know.
And then Dr. Calvert, what about the creche? What about the nativity scene?
Everyone loves the nativity scene and the creche. And every once in a while, you know, you'll see these poor people in the cold outside acting out the nativity scene. And for lots of churches, are, of course, the children in their parents' bathrobes and, you know, acting out.
I did it when I was young.
Yeah, me too. I did too. Where did all that begin? Well, actually, it began in the 13th century, the 1200s, with St. Francis of Assisi. He wanted to find a new way, really, to celebrate the nativity. And he was able to get, you know, this group of people from the community that he was in at that time together, and the monks that he was working with, get them all together. Live animals in a manger, you know, the whole thing that we have come to, you know, imagine. He was the first one that we know of who did that. And all of it very much a part of the ministry of St. Francis, who really wanted people to love the Christ child.
Is there any particular tradition or symbol for you that really captures the beauty, the truth of Christmas?
Yeah, I think that for me, the most important symbols, honestly, when Christians bring them into their Christmas celebration, is honestly the symbol of the cross. Hmm. And in, within the Catholic tradition, I'm Catholic, the crucifix, you know, Paul says, I boast in nothing but Christ and him crucified. You know, that's all we have to boast in, all we have to hope in. And that, the birth of Jesus, you know, Christmas celebration is always connected with Easter. It is always connected with the Passover, with the death and resurrection of Jesus, the death of sin, the resurrection to new life. I think that any Christian family who, you know, really incorporates that into their celebration of Christmas is just doing the right thing. And that's something that I always appreciate about Christmas, is bringing all of that together, the whole message, right? Yeah.
We hear critiques of the Christmas holiday today. It is too materialistic. The focus is too broadly upon giving, receiving gifts. Yeah. Maybe it's not inclusive enough for a pluralistic society like the one we have here in America. Is Christmas still a good?
Yeah, I think it is. I have to say that. I think that it is, you know, the word Christmas, it tells us it's kind of owned by the Christians, right? And even if we say holidays, you know, it's still a holy day.
Right.
And so, you know, what do you do with that? Well, I think there's a way in which, you know, across a pluralistic society, we can all appreciate this. Within Judaism, this is the time of Hanukkah, and that echoes back to the War of the Maccabees, in which the temple is cleansed, and, you know, there's oil in the lamps, and they're able to last out against a pagan oppressor. There is a sense in which we can, you know, affirm this idea of freedom from the oppression of sin and, you know, of the oppression that's upon us. Within Islam, there is a great appreciation for Jesus. He's not divine, but he is a great prophet. And in fact, within Islam, there is an appreciation of Mary, mm-hmm. More so than in many other religious expressions. And so, you know, there's a way to talk about that and to celebrate that with our Muslim neighbors. With those who are, you know, in the secular world, maybe if I have a libertarian friend, you know, this is a great opportunity to make some money and provide a forward movement for our economy and give us that Black Friday in which, you know, all of the budgets are met. Mm-hmm. You know, that this is a moment of celebration. You know, why not? You know, pop open a bottle of champagne and enjoy that. You know, I think the folks that are going to be less likely to join with us are those who are just going to reject all celebrations of a god, all celebrations of a religious nature. But even among, you know, our atheist friends and fellow citizens, I think just the idea of a time of joy, a time of celebration, I think they can certainly understand. And in God's general grace to all of our fellow citizens, you know, he's pouring out to them an opportunity to see what's possible, mm-hmm. right?
Dr. Ken Calvert is professor of ancient history here at Hillsdale College. We talk today about the history of Christmas. Dr. Calvert, thanks for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you, Scott. A great pleasure.
Up next, Dr. Chloe Carmichael joins us. Her new book is Can I Say That? Why Free Speech Matters and How to Use It Fearlessly. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
This show is a part of the Hillsdale College Podcast Network. If you like what you hear, please subscribe to your favorite. You'll get brand new episodes of all your favorite shows sent right to your device, and you'll help us know that you're out there listening. Never miss another episode by going to podcast.hillsdale.edu/subscribe. That's podcast.hillsdale.edu/subscribe. Or click the follow or subscribe button on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube.
Great books, great people, great ideas. Learning about these things is critical to being a well-educated human being, and we can help with the Hillsdale Dialogues. Each week, Hillsdale College President Larry Arn joins radio veteran Hugh Hewitt to discuss topics of enduring relevance. And from time to time, they also talk about current events, but always with an eye toward more fundamental truths. And they want you to tune in to a conversation like no other. The Hillsdale Dialogues are posted every Monday on the Hillsdale College Podcast Network at podcast.hillsdale.edu. That's podcast.hillsdale.edu. Or listen via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you find your audio.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Be sure to check out the Hillsdale College Podcast Network at podcast.hillsdale.edu or wherever you get your audio. We're joined by Dr. Chloe Carmichael. She is a clinical psychologist and USA Today best-selling author. You can find out more about her and this book we'll be discussing today at freespeechtoday.com. And the book is Can I Say That? Why Free Speech Matters and How to Use It Fearlessly. Dr. Carmichael, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Scott. It's great to be with you.
Thank you for the book as well. It's a very interesting read, and portions are unlike, I think, what you'll read in other books about this similar topic, right? I want to start early, though. You mentioned that as cancel culture and self-censorship rose in the country, so did loneliness. What's the correlation between those things?
Yeah. So when we're not being honest and authentic with people about what we really think because we're afraid of being canceled, or they're not being honest because they're afraid of being canceled, it degrades the quality of our social support. So, you know, you might even be surrounded by other people, but you could feel like the loneliest person in the world if nobody really knows how each other feels because they're all afraid of cancel culture.
Is what we've lived through the past 6 years, 8 years, relatively unique in, I don't want to say human history, but I guess, I mean, human history. Is this something that we haven't really dealt with before on an interpersonal level?
That's an interesting question. So as I was researching for my book, Can I Say That? Why Free Speech Matters and How to Use It Fearlessly, I actually looked into the etymology of the word censor because I was interested in self-censorship. And your brainy Hillsdale College community probably already knows this, but I learned that the word censor actually comes from Roman times, that they had these soldiers that were actually called censors, and they would go around throughout all of the, you know, territories and tell everybody living in those, you know, Roman controlled places what words and opinions and moral viewpoints were acceptable for them to have. And that is where now we get the word censor. So, you know, in some way we might feel like this is new, but what was actually new was the concept of freedom of speech. Mm-hmm. When our country, you know, was founded, that's what was new. I'm afraid what we're experiencing now is more of a regression to the mean.
This idea that words are violence is something that is ridiculous on its face, yet has been popularly accepted in some circles. Why is it so important to draw that distinction that words, in fact, are not violence?
Yeah, Scott, you said it perfectly. It's ridiculous on its face, right? But it sounds so catchy. It is important to understand it, though. You see, it's kind of an insidious phrase because it sounds like it's just trying to communicate to people, hey, you know, words can hurt, you know? Okay, fair. That's true. But words are not violence. Violence is a very special word within our judicial system, as well as in our basic human psyche, you know, which laid the foundation for our judicial system. Humans have an innate need for reciprocity, and we have an innate understanding of the concept of self-defense. So, you know, going all the way back to, you know, an eye for an eye or, you know, protect my home, that kind of thing. So when we start saying words are violence, what we're doing is we're setting up basically a self-defense argument for people to respond with actual violence to words that they don't like, just like we saw at UC Berkeley yet again. Mm-hmm. You know, and I say yet again because they were one of the worst offenders in 2017. They had a terrible riot over free speech when Young America's Foundation came there. So as a clinical psychologist, I call that phrase literally a psychotic. Psychotic means broken from reality. And so when people start saying words are violence, they are breaking from reality when they're starting to, you know, glom on to the idea that if somebody says something that you don't like, it's as if they're doing violence to you, and therefore you can respond in kind.
Dr. Chloe Carmichael is with us. Her new book, Can I Say That? Why Free Speech Matters and How to Use It Fearlessly. You mentioned UC Berkeley. Why is it so hard to use free speech fearlessly on our college campuses? Why are universities ground zero for so much of this problem?
Yeah, well, there's an increasingly leftist bent. I'm sure this is no great news flash to anybody here, but there's an increasingly leftist bent at our universities. For example, in the Northeast, Scott, you want to take a guess what the liberal to conservative faculty ratio is in the Northeast? Take a guess.
I will take a guess. I will be wrong. I'll say it's something along the lines of 20 to 1.
28 to 1. Okay. You're close. It's 28 to 1. And the number is only intensifying. So colleges and universities have long been, you know, left leaning. But unfortunately, what they're doing is they're becoming more and more biased and only admitting people who think like themselves. So the tilt is getting heavier and heavier. Well, actually, what that does is it literally creates what psychologists call groupthink, where you have, you know, there's eight main ingredients for groupthink, according to Irving Yanis, the psychologist who coined the terms. And one of them is something called the self-appointed mind guards. And that's basically what the professors have become, as if it's just now supposed to be gospel that because, you know, a university says it's better to use pronouns, you know, that therefore that's some kind of a gospel. And then we have all these, you know, wonderful, young, eager minds that maybe are even appropriately deferential, like they're going to a university, they're going to a certain point defer to the professors, assuming probably they know better and know more. And it just becomes basically a leftist, it's, you know, indoctrination center. I can really see why people are calling it that. And then students are afraid to step out because they're not only socially ostracized, they're intellectually shamed because the self-appointed mind guards, you know, are suggesting that only a buffoon would think this way. And then moreover, there's another ingredient of groupthink, which is direct pressure upon dissenters and, you know, grade point averages. That's some pretty direct pressure, letters of recommendation. I personally parroted a lot of talking points in order to get through my Ivy League education and get my PhD. So I know what it's like, and I'm so thankful for places like Hillsdale. I want my son to go there.
Dr. Chloe Carmichael with us. Can I Say That is the new book. And the first part of the book in which you lean into your training as a clinical psychologist is most interesting because, again, it's not very common to sort of approach the issue in this manner. Why do you argue that defending free speech is, in part at least, a mental health issue?
Yeah, so I
mean, Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.